I'm Marty Moscoway, and welcome to Radio Times. If you look at wealthy countries in Europe, you see death rates that are on the decline. People are living longer. That's also true in this country, except for middle-aged white Americans with a high school diploma or less. Princeton University economists Angus Deaton and Ann Case first identified this trend a few years ago, looking at rates of suicide, alcoholism, and drug overdose. They have expanded on their earlier work with a new study identifying what they call deaths of despair. These are people who can't get a good-paying job, have unstable relationships, and struggle with their mental and physical health. It's the collapse of a class of people who were enjoying a relatively stable lifestyle just a generation or two ago. So what happened? What does this tell us about our country? And what, if anything, can be done? Let me introduce our guests. Angus Deaton, senior scholar and professor of economics and international affairs emeritus at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton, won a Nobel Prize in economics back in 2015. A couple of months ago, he was knighted by the Queen of England. Angus Deaton, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be back again, Marty.
And also with us is Ann Case, and she's a professor of economics and public affairs, also director of the research program in development studies at Princeton University. And I should add that they are married to each other, and the title of their study is Mortality and Morbidity in the 21st Century, published in the spring edition of the Brookings Papers on Economic Activity. Ann Case, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, good to be with you.
And you see, let me begin with you, but in case I want you to weigh on this as well. And I was thinking, you know, most people in this country don't have a college degree. Millions of people are working low-wage jobs, experiencing the stress of either being working poor or just working just above poverty. Why are white people at greater risk?
That's one of the toughest questions that we don't really know the answer to. You know, we started out by identifying this particular group, these working class white people and people who don't have a BA, and seeing very much that they're at risk. So really one of the mysteries is why is it not happening the same way to black non-Hispanics? We have a number of ideas. I mean, it may be, and people often talk about this, that there's been a lot of progress for black Americans over the last 50 years, and that they still have a lot of hope, whereas for many white Americans, they don't feel that way, and they feel that their bright futures are no longer there. But It's really a matter of hypothesis at this point.
It's also interesting that it started well before the financial crisis. That we can actually take this all the way back to 1990, and there's just been a steady increase in suicide, drug overdose, alcohol-related deaths in the U.S.
Which raises a question, and I'll put this back to you, Ann Case, then. Is there something that happened in the 90s, and this was the Clinton era, the economy was going relatively gangbusters back then? Was there something about the 90s that's unique?
No, we actually think what happened was that with a change in technology, with jobs, good jobs for people who have less than a BA disappearing starting in the mid-1970s, that birth cohort by birth cohort coming into the labor market faced a more and more hostile situation, and that's possibly what we're seeing is that as each additional cohort comes online, they're facing higher risk of these deaths of despair and, you know, poorer chances to marry and have a stable life.
Let me go back to you, Angus Eden. Is this a largely rural phenomenon, or are you seeing this in metropolitan areas, in more rural areas across the country?
It's widespread across the country, and we're seeing these deaths increasing in all levels of urbanization. They're perhaps a little lower in the what you might call the suburbs around the large cities, but they're seeing the same inexorable increase that is happening in everywhere else too. I mean, what is unusual for the drug deaths is that these are among white non-Hispanic Americans, whereas if you go back to the last drug epidemic, the crack epidemic in, 30 years ago, that was largely among minorities. So that's a big change. And it's true that it's hitting rural America, but it's hitting all of America.
Deaths of despair and case is such a profound and depressing description of what we're talking about. We're talking about despair, which is depression, which is hopelessness.
It's true. When we started to peel back the onion about why mortality rates had flatlined among this group of Americans, and we saw that it was drugs and suicide and cirrhosis, we use deaths of despair as kind of a shorthand for those things. But we see that all as being either you kill yourself quickly with a gun or you kill yourself slowly with alcohol and drugs. And I kind of lost the rest of your question.
I'm thinking of, let's say, coal country. I mean, is that a good example of what we're talking about, Angus?
Yeah, I think it is. It's a good example, but I don't think it's very hard. I mean, you could drive pretty much to any police station in America, and you ask them how many people they're seeing who are dying or in threat of dying on park benches from drug overdoses. And you get that in Princeton, New Jersey. It's just not happening as much here as it would happen in places where there are more working class people. And, you know, a lot of this, the stuff that's part of this at least is the opioid crisis, mm-hmm. which has been sort of well documented by others too. And these are, you know, when we talk about the crackhead epidemic of 30 years ago, those right. were illegal drugs, but these are largely legal drugs that have been way over prescribed compared with in other countries, and people get addicted and then they die.
Well, and then they oftentimes turn to heroin because it's cheaper than an
exactly.
opioid. But if people are taking opioids, they are in some kind of pain. Is that what we're also talking about?
We are indeed. The body count is irrefutable, but underneath that body count, people year on year report themselves in worse physical health, a lot more pain, a lot more lower back pain, sciatic pain, chronic joint pain, and a lot more mental distress. So there's a big nationally representative study that's done every year, so you can compare year on year. And what you see is that for younger and younger birth cohorts, when you see them at the same age, the younger cohorts are just in much worse shape than the older ones.
So that's one of the things that, you know, we don't really know where this is coming from, and it may be that this is just one of the factors, but we think it may be well be connected up with people having worse jobs, and there's a higher risk of injury and things like that. So the pain is real, but, right. you know, the prescription of opioids to deal with the pain has probably made it worse rather than made it better, certainly in the sense that doctors know how to treat pain with opioids. What they don't know is how to cure the addiction that might result as a consequence of that. And then those people are sort of abandoned.
What I hear is a connection between jobs, pain, opioid addiction, perhaps difficult relationships. Is this kind of a circular problem?
A circular problem, although we are beginning to form a hypothesis that the kind of deepest underlying part of this is the labor market. That if it was the case a generation ago that your dad could go and get a good job and he saw a ladder up. You work hard, your wages increase with your experience on the job, you can make a good life for you and your family. And that those jobs are largely gone, either through technological change that makes them not necessary or they've been exported. So without a job where you see a ladder up, you may not find that you're a very good marriage prospect. And what we're finding is a lot more cohabitation that's not very stable. In Europe, there's a lot of cohabitation, but those are really stable relationships. But in the U.S., they're fragile. So you partner, you repartner, but when things are tough, you don't necessarily have a place to go home to where you can help to restabilize yourself day in, day out.
And you see, yeah, why are cohabitation relationships stable or more stable in Europe than they are in the United States?
Anne's grinning at me because you asked me the harder question.
Well, you're the one with the Nobel Prize, so I'll give
it to
you.
I'm the one
with the Nobel Prize. I don't have a Nobel Prize in cohabitation,
no,
unfortunately.
I know. I haven't made one yet.
I think there's, Andrew Cherlin, the sociologist in Baltimore, has written very well about this. And there's this sort of argument that marriage has always been valorized very heavily in the United States, more so than in Europe, and more so than among the African American community in America, who, after all, in the days of enslavement, were by and large not allowed to marry. So that when people cohabit in Europe, it's not like a poor substitute for marriage. So it's sort of like in America, people, you know, want the freedom of cohabitation, of not being married. On the other hand, they sort of miss it, and that creates a stress that you don't necessarily see in Europe in the same way. But the instability of these things is, you know, in Europe it just seems like they've relabeled it. So now, you know, you're not married anymore, but everything's pretty much the same as it was. I mean, that's not quite true, but it's true as a first approximation. In the United States, people... And that really is a change in social beliefs. I mean, 50 years ago, you just couldn't do that. You would have been ostracized, you know, socially disapproved of. So now it's allowed, but then the women say, well, you know, I found someone else who's got a better wage than you have, you know, who's getting promoted soon, and then they trade up. And you get these terrible things where, you know, children may have had multiple, quotes, fathers, unquotes, before they're teenagers. And, you know, we do think it's very important not to just – we think of the labor market and the incomes and the low wages and the low prospects as very much the beginning of the story, but it's not the end of the story. And if it wasn't working through these dysfunctional marriages, these dysfunctional bringing up children, the fact that your children don't have very good prospects, this probably would not drive people to despair in the way that just a temporary wage cut would.
We're almost up on a break here, Anne, but someone just tweeted at us, stress, question mark?
Absolutely. Pain is a really hard thing to fully understand, but a lot of people store stress in their bodies, and that doesn't make the pain any less real, but it means that the stress that comes from possibly not knowing how to put enough money together to keep body and soul together can out in the body. And when it outs in the body, it can come out in the form of neck pain, back pain, migraines.
That's Anne Case, who joins us along with Angus Deaton. They are economists at Princeton University. We're talking about some research they've been doing over the last couple of years, the fact that white middle-aged Americans without college degrees have higher rates of illness and death compared to their counterparts in Europe and also compared to other groups here in the United States. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Angus Deaton and Anne Case about their research. They are Princeton University professors. And just a recap here, in most European countries, people are living longer. But among white working class Americans, there has been an increase in mortality rates in recent years. Not all of it explained by the opioid epidemic, although certainly the epidemic in opioids has been a serious problem. You can join our conversation. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can text or call our comment line, and that's 267-405-2006. Angus Deaton, so if this group of people is doing better in Europe than they are in the United States, what does Europe have or what does Europe do that has improved their quality of life?
Well, you know, it would be really nice to know that for sure, but I can tell you some of the things that sound possible. One is that Europe has a much more elaborate safety net than we do. They have a lot more tax revenue, which comes in through the value-added tax, and they use that to support people when they're unemployed or to let people retire early, for example. So if you look at the balance of health and safety net spending, in the U.S., we spend a huge amount on our healthcare system, but very little on social safety nets. And in Europe, they spend much more on the social safety nets and much less on their healthcare system. So the healthcare system to us, you know, we've known for a very long time, economists have known, but I'm not sure it's well known among the general public, is that this incredibly expensive and rapidly expanding healthcare system we have is largely paid for out of wages.
Right.
So one of the major forces that's pushing down wages and pushing down job opportunities for people who are relatively poorly educated is this rising cost of healthcare system. So in some sense, our healthcare system is really killing people by denying them the economic opportunities that their fathers and grandfathers had, and indeed that Europeans still have.
I mean, that's an argument for a single-payer system. Is that what you are arguing?
Or something,
yeah. Some version of that? And is there less income inequality in European countries compared to this?
In general, there is, but we don't think that the income inequality per se is what's driving this. Because what you see is in Europe a 2% per year decline in mortality rates across all the countries of Europe. Mm-hmm. And the income inequality between them varies quite markedly. We think it's more people having despair when they look forward. Marty, we get a lot of emails from people who read our work. And a woman just wrote and talked about the fact that at a dinner party she joked with her friends that when she retired, her retirement plan was to become a greeter at Walmart. And she said no one at the table laughed because that was kind of all of their plans. They don't see that they have enough income to retire and to see themselves through to old age. In Europe, there's a different story, that people are well cared for and will continue to be well cared for, you know, and well into their elder years.
I mean, German firms still have something of this sort of cradle to grave schemes through apprenticeships very early in life and then looking after you if you're disabled in old age. And if you think, you know, even locally, if you think of the steelworks in Pennsylvania, if you go back into the early 70s, these were unionized steelworks with enormous labor forces. You got a pay rise every year as you got greater union seniority. And so you could expect to rise up the ladder when you got a good job. You could get married before you had kids, and you could build a middle-class life, what at the time was called the blue-collar aristocracy. Uh-huh. Those factories have gone. The unions have gone. There's no blue-collar aristocracy
defined
anymore.
Defined benefit pensions are gone. Those would be ones where you knew what you were going to get every month, and instead they're being replaced by, at best, defined contribution retirement schemes, which go up and down with the market. So people, as they think about retirement, also realize that they're going to be bearing a lot more risk during those years.
Well, you've raised a couple of questions there. And let me go back to you. You mentioned the fact that this phenomenon that we're talking about seemed to begin in the 1990s. I wonder about this more recent recession that we had, whether that was a kind of a knockout punch for this group of people we've been talking about.
It's really interesting. We were expecting, I think, to see that in the data, but instead what we see is this slow, steady rise in these deaths of despair. Mm-hmm. And it probably was happening even before 1990. It's just that our data only allow us to go back that far. And then in the mid-1990s, with prescription opioids, heavy-duty prescription opioids coming online, that was an accelerant. But you don't see either the go-go years of the 90s maybe having, you know, an effect of slowing down these deaths of despair, or and you don't see the Great Recession as being a place where they take off.
Yeah, and also, you know, it's been known. People really don't believe it. It's so counterintuitive that deaths tend to go up in good times economically and go down in bad times. And, you know, some of the countries in Europe were really, really much worse hit than the U.S. by the recession. Spain, where unemployment went from something like 5 to 28%, and every category of mortality got better over that period.
How can we understand that, Angus Deaton?
Well, I mean, I think part of it is things you might think. You know, when people get better off, they buy fast cars, they drive around. There's probably a lot more pollution during times like that. One of the mechanisms that's been seen in the U.S. is that a lot of these extra deaths in good times are among the elderly, because it's harder for nursing homes where they're looking after old people to hold labor because there's so much other good jobs for them at that time. So these are not very obvious mechanisms, but they seem to be quite strongly there. And what Anne says, I think, is really important, that this goes back into the 70s. And
She just whispered, "We don't know that," but I heard you. I heard you.
Well, but the roots of it go back into the 70s this decline in marriage rates, this decline in labor force participation, people are just not – a lot of people have just pulled out of the labor market. And so it's a terribly unhealthy situation. I mean, some people like Charles Murray put it down to a loss of virtue that people are not industrious anymore.
Do you believe that?
Well, there's been a change in mores. I mean, I think it's not a great idea that people – you're free to have kids out of wedlock, or that you're free to cohabit. So that is genuinely a change in culture, which I think in the end has really hurt people. That's the sort of conservative opinion. But we tend to think that it is these changes in the labor market, the technical changes, the globalization, you know, the vanishing of the steelworks and so on, that have made it really very hard for people to establish this sort of prosperous working class lives that they used to have. They just don't seem to be there anymore.
And if I can weigh it, I just think virtue is much easier to maintain if you have a good job.
Of course. Yes, I would agree with that.
I would not have a,
Well, let me ask you, Anne, is this affecting men and women equally? I remember doing a show a couple of years ago after the sort of the worst of the most recent recession, and it was a show that we called, or others called, you know, the man session, the fact that men seem to be harder hit by this most recent recession than women. Does that also show up in some of your study?
It really doesn't, and it's interesting because men and women, deaths from these deaths of despair are rising in parallel, and they've been rising in good times and in bad in parallel. So some media would like to make this a women's crisis and will say that women are dying in record numbers, blah, blah, and some like to call it a men's crisis. And so the headline might read, "White men dying," even though the report itself talks about men and women. So it being men and women helps us to rule out, we think, a few possible things that could be the underlying factors, like the fact that veterans have a much harder time with mental health. And so, but first of all, it couldn't be large enough a group, but second of all, we would expect then it to be hitting men much harder than women, and this is something that's hitting men and women in parallel.
No, let me just say one qualification on that. It's important to understand because it's very easy to get confused over this. If you take something like suicide, it's a very good example. I mean, men kill themselves much, much more frequently than women do. But if you look at the increase in suicides, it's been the same for men and women. Mm-hmm. So it's those increases that are tracking in parallel, but women remain at a lower level.
Of all three of these.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Angus Deaton and Case, and we've been talking about some work that they've been doing over the last couple of years, finding that among white working class Americans, there's been an increase in mortality rates in recent years, meaning that they are dying at an increased rate compared to others. They have done some more recent research to try to explain this increase and have found something they call deaths of despair, things like lack of a good job or marriage breakups or family dysfunction, social isolation, even things like obesity. You can join our conversation by sending us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can text or call our comment line, 267-405-2006. A text from a listener: if a depressed marriage prospects are such a big factor, is this really a problem for uneducated whites or uneducated white men? And I think you might have answered that, but either of you want to weigh in on that?
Well, it seems to, the story is that it's the men who start with these lower wages and lower prospects, and that makes it hard for them to get married. But it doesn't, under current social mores, stop them from cohabiting or from having children. Now, that's bad for the man, and it's bad for the woman, because the woman has these children that she finishes up being a single mom or a serial mom with lots of men. It's not great for the kids either, because some of these fathers, in quotes, are not really going to be very suitable as fathers. And if they are suitable as fathers, then it's a great loss to the children when they move on in turn. And, you know, this connects up with, say, the work that Bob Putnam has done on our kids and how difficult it is for them to find good opportunities. And the real question is whether working class kids have the same opportunity now that our generation did, or my generation, Bob Putnam's generation did, 40, 50 years ago. So it's a sort of whole social world that's coming apart. And that's one of the reasons we find this story so compelling, because you don't kill yourself. You know, you don't get this mass epidemic of this pain and suicides going on just because of temporary setbacks in the labor
market. But if having a college degree increases your chance for a better life or maybe even happiness or more stability, and case is the goal, then we should just make sure people have more education and a college degree of some sort?
That's a really good question. What do we do next, or how do we try to come in and make a difference here? And there's a difference, I think, between the way Angus and I would answer this question. I think that we need to really rethink K-12 education so that we can send people out with a kind of skill set that would help them in the 21st century labor market. I don't think everyone should go to college. Not everyone wants a four-year degree. Not everyone has the wherewithal to do that. But certainly the kind of technical training that people are going to need if they're going to actually be able to participate in this labor market is something we're going to have to look at really carefully. I don't know if Angus wants to bat back at me.
No, I agree with that. I mean, I think there are a lot of kids who want to go to college who don't get to go to college because their counselors or their high schools, you know, don't push them, or because their high schools are so bad that they've never sent anyone to college. So doing something about that and enabling people to have these opportunities would be great. I also think we should think more about something like the German apprenticeship system. When I go out in the world and talk to CEOs, for instance, they're always saying how, you know, maybe people can't find jobs, but they can't find workers for the skills that they need. And so there seems to be a fairly serious potential mismatch there. That's something that maybe we could do. But you should always remember that people without a BA are not the same as people with a BA. So it's not just a question of injecting them with education and they'll turn into different sorts of people. And there's a lot of changes in the way that labor markets work. You know, there's a lot of outsourcing, for instance. So you might have a company that used to have all its workers work for it, you know, the restaurant staff, the cleaners, and all the rest of it. Now, if you go to a big company, a high-tech company, for instance, you'll discover that those people don't work for that high-tech company anymore. So they don't belong to the company. They don't have the benefits that used to come with the company. They work for some other company which has lower wages and much harsher working conditions. So it's not just education.
Sure. I mean, isn't that an argument in case for a living wage? I mean, people, you cannot afford in any way a middle-class lifestyle if you're making $10, $12 an hour. It just isn't possible.
That's absolutely right. There are a couple of things, though, that makes the U.S. different from Europe on the idea of how we go about trying to shore up people who are falling through the cracks here. The U.S. is much more focused on the individual, right? We grew up with this idea that I take care of my family, you take care of your family, and we like it that way. And a lot of people think of a hand up as being kind of a hand out, which doesn't appeal to them at all. And so I think the way that we go about trying to bring relief here is going to be much more of a challenge for the U.S. than it was in Western Europe.
Interesting. We're almost out of time here. An email from Diana who says, does your study correlate with red states, blue states? Is there a higher mortality rate evident more in red states than in blue states? Can you take this, Angus Deaton?
Yeah, there's a very strong spatial correlation between the people who voted for Donald Trump and these deaths. And, you know, when we first saw that, we were very impressed by it. But, of course, it's not that surprising. I mean, in that you could put obesity rates on there. You could put almost any dysfunction on there. And there's this strong correlation with people who voted for Trump. But, yes, it's very strongly related that way. And so these are the people who voted for Donald Trump. These are people whose lives have come apart. And they would like to make America great again. And they would like to go back to this blue-collar, middle-class living style, which is not available to them anymore. The trouble is none of us really know how to get there. Hmm. I mean, there are things like single-payer that we think would help a lot, and we think a somewhat more generous social safety net would be terrific, too. And I think we're going to have to go in some of those directions.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there and perhaps pick up on where we left off. My thanks to both of you. Angus Deaton, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times. And Case, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having us.
Pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you both with us. And again, Angus Deaton, senior scholar, the professor of economics and international affairs emeritus at Princeton University, and Case, professor of economics and public affairs, director of the research program, also at Princeton University. Their study is titled Mortality and Morbidity in the 21st Century. After this very sharp break, talking with David Folkenflik about Bill O'Reilly. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Bill O'Reilly is on vacation, telling his Fox viewers on Tuesday, "We all need R&R. Put it to good use." The popular host of The O'Reilly Factor is under fire after the New York Times revealed that the network had paid $13 million to five former Fox female staffers, part of a settlement agreement involving allegations of sexual harassment. Now, more than 50 advertisers have pulled their spots from his show. There have been protests outside the news headquarters and grumbling inside as the Murdoch family decides what to do. We asked David Folkenflik to join us. He covers media for NPR, joining us from the studios of NPR. And David, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to join you, Marty.
Is the audience walking away like the advertisers?
Not at all. It's a moment of huge interest for viewers because of we're in the Donald Trump era. And so you've seen a viewership go up into almost crazy measure for Fox News, but also to MSNBC and to a degree for CNN as well. It's a time to thrive if you're on cable news. And in addition, there's a bit of tribalism to Fox's audience in a way there isn't to CNN or really to MSNBC as well. And if Fox is under attack or under siege or perceived to be, then a lot of core viewers will rally to the flag.
Has his show been any different since that story came out from the New York Times?
Well, I think it's worth pointing out that Bill O'Reilly and Fox News has known that this has been in the work for many months. And one way in which we know that that's the case is that Fox re-signed Bill O'Reilly to a multi-year contract after the election, the beginning of the year, basically, and did so without any fanfare whatsoever, did not want to advertise that fact, waiting for the shoe to drop. But when the shoe dropped, you know, context is everything.
Right.
Just as you said, there are $13 million in settlements, in some cases to forestall lawsuit, in other cases to quash any public acknowledgement of this whatsoever. The largest single payment was about $9 million, and it was done over a decade ago. show to a former producer who had sued O'Reilly in public and had him on tape making incredibly graphic sexual advances to her and indicating what he expected of her in a pretty shocking way once it's noticed by others. And we knew that. At least it was part of the public record then. What changed? Well, what changed was last summer, Roger Ailes was dragged down by a series of allegations, seemingly with some heft, all of which he denies, by a number of women at Fox, including some of the most famous, who said that he sexually harassed them. So suddenly, the fact that O'Reilly had himself, and along with Fox News and its corporate parents, paid millions of dollars to settle things, accusations by women, and that some of those settlements occurred after Roger Ailes himself was forced out last summer, you know, it creates a very different context for this New York Times story to fall.
And raises a question, why does he still have a job at Fox?
Oh, it's one of the primary questions. Why does he do it? And the answer is he's a money machine. The weird thing is that although you think the natural inclination is to think differently about this, that advertising is the most important source of revenue for Fox News, a place like that. Actually, the most important source of revenue is how much cable providers like Comcast, like Spectrum, like the old Time Warner, whomever, pays to individual cable stations to carry their channels. Fox earns a little bit south of $2 a viewer, a household, when you think of the fact that there's something like 85 million plus households in this country that that have cable or satellite TV. That's a whole lot of money every month. That said, there was a lot of money that also comes via advertising. Bill O'Reilly is clearly the number one individual moneymaker for Fox News, estimated at close to $150 million a year in advertising.
Wow.
And Fox News is itself one of the primary economic engines driving the Murdoch family's media empire. So when you have Rupert Murdoch, who's personally been leading Fox News since Roger Ailes was forced out, and his sons, who help him run the parent company, 21st Century Fox, they have to think about, do we want to dislodge a guy who's important to us for two reasons. One, he makes all this money. And two, in the age of Donald Trump, having a guy who's sort of a bombastic, older, white guy who speaks to kind of, in some ways, white working class grievances, you know, who's been accused of sexual misconduct and has defended himself from it, as Trump has. These two guys are in some ways of the same stripe and of the same moment. And in some ways, he's a great face for Fox, aside from the fact that he's completely surrounded by scandal.
Well, and just to add to what you just said there, David, President Trump said, I don't think Bill did anything wrong. He should not have settled. I don't know if that hurts Bill O'Reilly or helps him, certainly after the candidate Trump's hot mic comment. It's just a little queasy feeling to even think about that.
Yeah, and let's remember, the candidate's hot, and I am happy to be the one to say this, but the candidate's hot mic comment came when he wasn't a candidate. It was over a decade ago. He was being taped as part of something promoting his reality show on an entertainment news show. And what he described was boasting about essentially a sexual assault on a woman who was a coworker at NBC and his inability to get as far as he'd like sexually with her. Most people don't seem to doubt whether or not he made these comments. He made the comments and don't seem to doubt that this reflects at least what he would like to be thought of as having done. And even he offered a very rare apology for it, which is not Donald Trump's way. But I don't think that's why people voted for him, to figure out whether or not he was the arbiter of whether other people are in fact guilty of sexual harassment that they've been accused of. I think he's offering a testimonial to say it's okay to root for this guy. I do. And so for people who are supportive of Donald Trump, either politically or personally, it's a signal to them, you can stick with Bill O'Reilly. He's been good to me, and I'm going to be good to him. Just as Bill O'Reilly went out on Seth Meyers' show and elsewhere and defended Donald Trump when these allegations came forward about Trump, and when the New York Times and other publications found other women who made similar accusations of sexual harassment against Donald Trump. O'Reilly vouched for him and says, when you're successful like me, when you're rich like me, you get to be a target, and that's why women came forward. Well, there are two women right now who are making continued allegations against Ailes. One of them is a suspended colleague, Andrea Tanteros, who was a host on The Five and is suspended now because of her lawsuit against O'Reilly and against the network and some of its executives. And another is a woman I talked to, Wendy Walsh.
Yeah.
And she's not suing for any money, but she has filed a formal complaint. And it is that complaint working itself through the system at Fox News, newly set up, that the Murdochs are going to pin a lot of O'Reilly's future to it, too. If they want to, they can use that to get rid of him if it turns up enough probable cause. If they don't, they're going to deep six it, as they've basically ultimately dismissed the other allegations, even though they paid millions of dollars to make them go away.
What's the mood at the cable network? And what specifically, what are female employees telling you? Are they talking to you? What do they say about what it's like to work there?
I've talked to women up and down, you know, from relatively junior jobs to very senior jobs in that company. And there is palpable contempt and disgust for O'Reilly. And dismay at the network itself. There's a skepticism towards the Murdochs, who said, you know, we are going to change this culture. And the Murdochs can point to a number of things, from what they did when the Gretchen Carlson, the former Fox host, filed a lawsuit last summer. They got rid of Roger Ailes. That's a big deal. He made them, you know, billions over the years, and he really was the creative force behind Fox News from its real launch in 1996. They brought in a new senior human resources executive. They created a hotline for employees. They created they hired an outside law firm to evaluate some of the allegations. So they just hired a new chief financial officer after forcing out the last one, and they can say, look, that person's a woman as well. We're bringing in women to more senior leadership positions. Everything's changed. People can settle down. And other people can say, you know, you guys still settled complaints essentially covertly after Roger Ailes was forced out. So executives were involved in who had been involved in payouts before he left that were surreptitious were involved with them after he left. They can point to the fact that that a lot of those executives remain in place. They can point to the fact that they don't – that a lot of the executives were people they had complained to previously who had not seen to things. They can point to a current racial discrimination lawsuit against the network, which caused the ouster of their comptroller a couple weeks ago, just days before the lawsuit was filed, that showed just – that Fox essentially acknowledged all of the allegations as having occurred, these vicious racist stereotypes being perpetrated on employees there. There's real skepticism about the willingness of the Murdochs to act unless and until they are absolutely forced to at the final minute. That there seems to be a culture where they're willing to pay, according to a lot of employees, rather than willing to really deal with the underlying causes of such a hideous workplace experience.
Well, the Murdochs say they want to create a work environment based on trust and respect. There is this hotline number that you mentioned, David. Are people calling it? Has it been used? I know that was one of the reasons that they complained about some of these allegations, is that no one called our hotline.
Well, you know, that is one of the reasons why Wendy Walsh, who I mentioned earlier, actually sat with her lawyer and she taped it as she called, but she did call the hotline, was to cut that off as a defense of O'Reilly. And that may have ultimately prove costly to him as she's set a process in motion. We'll see how seriously the allegations prove to be founded or evaluated by the outside law firm Paul Weiss, and we'll also see what they do with those findings. But nonetheless, there is a process in place, and that could be perilous for O'Reilly. The problem is that the people who previously ran HR and certainly the current general counsel, the top lawyer for the network, are basically in place, aside from the very top HR executive. And so they didn't trust human relations to take their complaints seriously, because when you have the chairman of the network being a serial sexual harasser, as everyone except Roger Ailes himself and his lawyers now say is the case, the executives below him are not functioning to try to help their employees. They're functioning to keep the network afloat and to keep their top executive in place. So you had an entire system of enabling, an entire system where the one guy who you look to be the ultimate arbiter of fairness in the workplace is the guy perpetrating the unfairness, at least according to these myriad allegations that the Murdochs themselves now acknowledge or attest to be true. So there's not a lot of trust built into that system. That's trust that's going to have to be earned rather than declared.
That's David Folkenflik, a very familiar voice to listeners here at WHYY. He covers media for NPR, and we asked him to join us to, frankly, get us up to speed on what's been happening at Fox. The fact that the Times, just a week or so ago, revealed that the network had paid something like $13 million to Fox five former Fox staffers who happen to be women, part of a settlement agreement involving allegations of sexual harassment. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. In fact, we have a tweet from Eric who says, if Ailes did the same thing O'Reilly did, was accused of, why were there no settlement payouts on his behalf? Or were there, David?
Oh, there were a bunch. Not only the $20 million payout to Gretchen Carlson to ensure that her lawsuit never saw the light of day, for she had Roger Ailes on tape harassing her. Again, he denies it, but that's his denial. They seem to be fairly credible and substantiated allegations. But also there had been a number of secret payouts. I mean, they go back to 2011. There was a woman who was a booker, which means somebody who gets guests and plans for them to be on the air, who rose to be an events planner and other things. And for, you know, she, by her own account, has been troubled over the years, but she worked for Fox News and for essentially Ailes for over 20 years. And for that entire 20-some year period, she said that her career advancement was determined by her continued giving of sexual act on Ailes. And one way in which he ensured that occurred was that he ensured that she did a striptease earlier on. He videotaped it. He put it in a safe and he said, now I have that. Now you understand where we stand with each other. I have this hold over you. And she felt like she would be exposed and blackmailed if she ever said a word about it. She was paid $3 million in a secret payment arranged in part by the current president of Fox News, co-president, a guy named Bill Shine, and by the current general counsel, Diane Brandy, both of them still in place. They said that they only realized later she was telling the truth. They thought she was troubled. It's hard to square that with a $3 million payment made from the coffers of essentially the shareholders of 21st Century Fox and Fox News. You know, that would seem to be a major payment as a red flag that he wasn't doing anything. Other women ultimately were paid off money to go away as well over the years, and certainly after his departure.
Is Fox an outlier when it comes to either TV news or cable news and these allegations, these charges of sexual harassment?
You know, you hear that in the entertainment fields and in media, particularly TV media, where the Klieg lights burn so bright for celebrity, that there's a sense of entitlement, particularly among men in powerful positions in the executive suites or you know, who are prominent anchors. But you don't hear about, in this day and age, anything like the endemic cultural assumption that this is how you treat women who work for you or aspire to work for you or work with you. There's just, you know, there are individuals who are rumored or have been alleged to have behaved this way. But you've got the chairman creating a culture. And remember, he created the network with Rupert Murdoch. He, you know, this is his DNA baked in there. It's his sense of how it works. It was essentially run. He used to run campaigns for Republican presidential candidates and successful ones at that. You know, it was like a political campaign. It was run in a very paranoid style, this network. And it turned out that Roger Ailes did have something to fear. He had fear of exposure of the secret of how he had behaved for decades towards the women who worked for him at Fox. And that was something that completely warped and distorted the nature, according to the many, many, many employees and many, many women at Fox I've spoken to, you know, warped the nature of the very network itself from the inside out.
And we have about a minute before we have to say goodbye. Now, Bill O'Reilly says that he's done nothing wrong. He wanted to protect his children. That's why these payouts were given. Was this vacation, from your perspective, David, was this in the works, as he said, or does that matter?
People at Fox claim that he bought tickets a long time ago, but he is in the middle of the maelstrom. He is the most vulnerable he has ever been, and this is not the first scandal he's had. You know, he is on thin ice. If the Murdoch sons, particularly James Murdoch, can convince their father Rupert to get rid of him, this would be perfect grist to do it. You know, what they know is that he is the public face of a scandal that's larger than that. And one last thing, there is a federal investigation currently going on about how Fox structured payment to women to hide things about Roger Ailes, but also possibly Bill O'Reilly. If the feds press on to indictments, it'll be very hard for them to continue with Bill O'Reilly as their most famous face.
Well, to be continued. David Folkenflik, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
You bet.
And he covers media for NPR. And that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for a newsletter, and listen to us on satellite radio. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Artie Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you.